People who operate from starvation economies can become very possessive about the people, things, and ideas that matter to them. They see the whole world in that limited light, so that anything they get comes from a small pool of not enough, and must thus be taken from someone else. And similarly, anything anyone else gets must be subtracted from them. It is important to distinguish between starvation economies and real-world limits. Time, for example, is a real-world limit. Even the most dedicated slut has only 24 hours every day. Love is not a real-world limit. The mother of 9 children can love each of them as much as the mother of an only child. Our belief is that the human capacity for sex and love and intimacy is far greater than most people think, possibly infinite, and that having a lot of satisfying connections simply makes it possible for you to have a lot more. Imagine what it would feel like to live in an abundance of sex and love, to feel that you had all of both that you could possibly want, free of any feelings of deprivation or neediness. Imagine how strong you would feel if you got to exercise your love muscles that much, and how much love you would have to give. Openness can be the solution, not the problem. Is sexual adventurousness simply a way to avoid intimacy? Not ordinarily in our experience. While it is certainly possible to misuse your outside relationships to avoid problems or intimacy with your life partner, we do not agree that this pattern is inevitable or even common. Many people, in fact, find that their outside relationships can increase their intimacy with their primary partner by reducing the pressures on that relationship and by giving them a safe place to discuss issues that may have them feeling stuck in the primary relationship. This chapter contains some of our beliefs. You get to have beliefs of your own. What matters to us is not that you agree with us, but that you question the prevailing paradigm and decide for yourself what you believe. Exercise your judgment. Isn't exercise supposed to make you stronger? Thousands and thousands of ethical sluts are proving every day that the old everybody knows myths don't have to be true. We encourage you to explore your own realities and create your own legend, one that spurs you onward in your evolution, supports you as you grow, and reflects your pride and happiness in your newfound relationships. Chapter 4, Slut Styles. Ethical sluthood is a house with a lot of rooms. It shelters everyone from happy celibates to ecstatic orgiasts and beyond. In this chapter, we'll talk about the many styles of sluthood that have worked for us, for the people we know, and for happy sluts throughout history. Whether or not any of these scenarios fit you, we hope they will offer you some ideas about where to start your exploration, or perhaps the validation of knowing that there are others like you out there. Relationship pioneers. Although the phrase ethical slut is new, Dossie coined it in 1995, the practice is not. Cultural acceptance of practices outside monogamy has rollercoastered up and down from acceptance to stern rejection, but regardless of the opinions of church and state, there have always been those who have found happiness and growth in sexual openness. Ancient cultures. You could spend your life as a cultural anthropologist trying to describe the innumerable ways that human beings have chosen to be together, sexually, romantically, and domestically, from the temple prostitutes of ancient Babylon to Mormon polygamy and far, far beyond. So, rather than trying to list them all, we just want to note that the prevailing cultural values that 21st century North America inherited from Europe seem to date back to the Roman Empire and to early Christianity, which recommended monogamous marriage only for those who couldn't manage celibacy, the ideal state. Cultures without those influences have developed all sorts of ways for people to bond. Polygamy, many wives. Polyandry, many husbands. Group marriage. Arrangements in which marriage is fundamentally a domestic business relationship and sexual dalliance takes place elsewhere. Ritual group sex. And pretty much any other configuration of human hearts and genitals that you can imagine. utopian sexual communities. History is dotted with experiments in creating intentional sexual utopias, often with a philosophical or religious basis. If you're curious, read up on the Oneida community of 19th century Ohio, Rajneeshpuram in India from the late 1960s and Oregon in the 1980s, and Carista in New York, Belize, and San Francisco from the early 1960s through the 1990s, to name just a few. Such communities are usually built by one leader and may falter when the leader is no longer available. However, their philosophies live on, adding new visions and practices to the mainstream culture. Many practitioners of Western Tantra today, for example, can trace their practice to the teachings of Osho, the guiding spirit behind Rajneeshpuram. Artists and Freethinkers. It's easy to point to artists and writers who have built their lives around intentional exploration of alternative relationships. If you're curious about the ways in which alternative relationships played out in times when there was even less support than there is now, you can read up on the Bloomsbury Group in early 20th century England, and freethinkers like George Sand, H.G. Wells, Simone de Beauvoir, Alfred Kinsey, and Edna St. Vincent Millay. What we can't know is how many non-writers were also building the kind of sexually open lives that worked for them, because there are no records of such lives. We feel safe in supposing, though, that a significant minority of people have always gotten their needs met through ethical, multi-partnered living. The Love Generation. Dasi came of age surrounded by the utopian concepts of the 1960s, and Janet shortly afterwards. Both of us have been influenced greatly in our thinking and our lives by those days of radical exploration. Many ideals of that era, nonconformity, exploration of altered states of consciousness, equality of race and gender, ecological awareness, political activism, openness about sexuality, and yes, the possibility of ethical and loving non-monogamy, have permeated the greater culture. We very much doubt that we could have written this book or published it in the 1950s. So if you're reading and enjoying The Ethical Slut today, thank a hippie. Sluthood today. Sluts come in all the various forms and styles that humans come in. Men and women in all cultures, from all parts of the world, of all religious lifestyles, rich and poor, with formal and informal education. Most of us today live in communities of non-sluts, with only occasional or limited contact with other people who share our values. Some groups hold conferences and conventions to mitigate isolation and expand their members' intimate circles. These conferences are very important in bringing sexual undergrounds into the view of those who are looking for them and building institutions above ground that can better support their members. Other sluts drop out of mainstream culture to some extent to live in communities composed of people whose sexuality is like their own. San Francisco's Castro District is a good example of a modern urban ghetto for sexual minorities. A slut living in mainstream monogamy-centrist culture in the 21st century can learn a great deal from studying other cultures, other places, and other times. You are not the only one in the world who has ever tried this. It can work. Others have done it without harming themselves, their lovers, their kids, without, in fact, doing anything except enjoying themselves and each other. Pioneering sexual subcultures with extensive documented and undocumented histories include communities of gay men and lesbian women, transgender groups, bisexuals, the leather communities, the swing communities, and some spiritually defined subcultures of pagans, modern primitives, and radical fairies. And that's just in the United States. Even if you don't belong to any of these sexually oriented communities, it's worth taking a look at them for what they can teach us about our own options as they develop ways of being sexual, ways of communicating about being sexual, and ways of living in social and family structures that are alternative to sex-negative traditions in America. Dasi's favorite dance club in 1970 was a remarkable mini-culture of polymorphous perversity. She remembers, "The Omni, short for omnisexual, was a small North Beach bar whose patrons were men and women, straight, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and often transgendered. The sexual values were very open, from hippie free love freaks to sex industry professionals, and most of us came there to dance like wild women and cruise like crazy. Thanks to the large transgender faction, There was no way of pigeonholing the person you were cruising into your categories of desire. You might dance with someone you found very attractive and not know if they were chromosomally male or female. It's difficult to get attached to preferences like lesbian or straight when you don't know the gender of the person you are flirting with. This may sound crazy, but the results were surprising. I patronized the Omni because it was the safest environment available to me. Because there was no way to make assumptions, people had to treat each other with respect. No one could assume what kind of interaction might interest the object of their attention, so there was nothing to do but ask. And if you were, as I was, a young woman in your 20s, to be approached with respect was a most welcome relief from straight social environments where it was customary for men to prove their manhood by coming on too strong, evidently in the belief that women who cruise in singles bars have problems with virginal shyness and don't mean no when they say it. The Omni provided my first experiences with true respect. Since we see some of the problems in attaining a free and open expression of our own individual sexuality as having to do with living in a sex role-bound culture, we have found it useful to learn from people who have shifted the boundaries of what it means to be male or female, or what it means to choose partners of the same or opposite sex. Thinking about different ways of living and loving can help us as we consider whether we want to change anything about how we go about living as men and women or somewhere in between. Lesbian women. In the lesbian community, we get to look at what happens in a world consisting almost entirely of women. For women, relationship can get confused with their sense of identity, especially since our culture in its most traditional form hardly allows women any sense of identity at all. Thus, many women act as if they would lose their entire sense of themselves without their relationship. The most common relationship sequence, as we see it magnified in the lesbian community, is the form of non-monogamy known as serial monogamy. Often the connection to the partner of the future precedes the breakup with the partner of the past, with accompanying drama that presumably feels safer than the vast, empty, unknown, and terrifying identity void of being a woman living as a single human being. Younger lesbians are questioning these traditions, and often that questioning includes looking into non-monogamy as a way to form less insular relationships. Lesbian polyamory is characterized by a lot of serious thoughtfulness and attention to consensuality, and thus to tremendous openness about processing feelings, an area in which the women's community excels. Our lesbian sisters also have a lot to teach us about new ways of developing a woman's role as sexual initiator. In heterosexual culture, men have been assigned the job of initiator, and men are trained to be sexually aggressive, sometimes to a fault. In the world of women who relate sexually to other women, it rapidly becomes apparent that if we all see ourselves as sleeping beauties waiting for Princess Charming to come along and wake us up, we might also get to wait 100 years. Or else, we need to learn to do something new. To meet the eye, touch the shoulder, move in a little closer, or just plain blurt out, "I think you're really attractive, would you like to talk?" Women's style of coming on, when shyness doesn't get in the way, tends to be forthright, with respect for consent, and is unlikely to be intrusive or pushy, as many women have had a little too much experience with being violated to want to go down that road. Women have strong concerns about safety, and so tend to move slowly and announce their intentions. They may be shy in the seductive stages and bolder once welcome has been secured. Women tend to want explicit permission for each specific act, so their communication could serve as an excellent role model for negotiated consensuality. We would like to draw your attention to another illuminating difference about sex between women. A sexual encounter between two women rarely involves the expectation of simultaneous orgasm, as many people believe penis-vagina intercourse should, so women have become experts at taking turns. Lesbians are world-class experts on sensuality and outercourse, those wonderful forms of sexuality that do not rely on penile penetration. When penetration is desired, the focus is on what works for the recipient. We have yet to meet a dildo that got hung up on its own needs. For those of you, female or male or gay or straight, who haven't considered these options, think of all the fun you could have with never a worry about pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases. Gay men. The gay male community reflects some of the traditional images of male sexuality in intensified form. While some gay men are indeed interested in long-term relationships and settling down, many have set records as world-class sluts. The gay baths are the ultimate role model of friendly group sex environments and easy sexual connection for its own sake. Dossie learned her group sex etiquette from gay men and is glad she did. We both, in fact, have always identified strongly with gay men. Dossie sees herself as a drag queen trapped in a woman's body. And Janet calls herself a girl fag, a gay man who happens to have breasts and a vagina. This may not really be too surprising, since the gay male community has always modeled sluttery for the rest of us to admire and, perhaps, emulate. Gay male sex, as a rule, starts from a presumption of equal power, without the dynamic of overpowerment and withholding that often pervades male-female interactions. Thus, men do not generally try to get consent from each other by manipulation and pressuring. Connection is more commonly made by a gentle approach, meeting a gentle response, and no need to ask three times. Gay men give each other a lot of credit for being able to say no, and for meaning it when they say it. This makes coming on very simple, since you are never trying to sneak up on anybody and you are not required to be subtle. It is always okay to ask as long as it is okay for the other person to say no. This straightforward and admirably simple approach to consensuality cannot be recommended too highly. Men in general have had less reason to fear sexual violation than their sisters. Although it is true and terrible that boys do get molested and men do get raped, men seem to have more confidence than women in their power to protect themselves. Men also tend to get a lot of cultural support for being sexual. So although the forbiddenness of homosexuality may give many gay men a lot of questions about being okay, or having something wrong with them, or other forms of internalized homophobia, this is most often not reflected in sexual dysfunction. Gay men as a group are really good at exploring and finding out what feels good to them. And it is gay men who have established most of our understanding of safer sex. In the face of the AIDS epidemic, where many people might have retreated into sex negativism, the gay community held its ground and continued to create environments where hot, creative, safer sex could be learned and practiced. Bisexuals. Often stigmatized as gays unwilling to relinquish heterosexual privilege, or hets taking a walk on the wild side, bisexuals have recently begun developing their own forceful voice and their own communities. Looking at the theory and practice of bisexual lifestyles offers opportunities to explore our assumptions about the nature of sexual and romantic attraction and behaviors. Some folks have had sex only with members of one gender, but know that they have within them the ability to connect erotically or emotionally with both genders and thus consider themselves bisexual, while others may be actively having sex with the gender opposite their usual choice, and still consider themselves heterosexual or gay. Some bisexuals prefer one type of interaction with men and another with women, while others consider themselves to be gender blind. Some can be sexual with either sex but romantic with only one, or vice versa, and so on through all the spectrums of bisexual attractions and choices. Bisexuals challenge a lot of our assumptions about gender, and many bis can tell you what is different for them between sex with a woman and sex with a man. This interesting and privileged information can provide all of us with new stories about sex and gender. The increasing visibility of bisexuality has led to some challenges to traditional definitions of sexual identity. Specifically, we are having to look at the fact that our sexual attractions may say one thing about us, while our sexual behaviors say another, and our sexual identity says yet a third. Questions like these are eating away at some of the traditional boundaries we place around sexual identity, much to the dismay of purists of all orientations. Your authors, sluts that we are, enjoy this kind of fluidity and appreciate the opportunity to play as we like with whoever looks good to us, without relinquishing our fundamental sexual identities. Janet's path toward her current identity as a bisexual has been a confusing one. It was nearly a decade after she began having sex with women before she began to feel comfortable using the term to describe herself. Janet says,
I felt turned off by the trendiness of bisexual chic and under some pressure to claim an identity that didn't feel right to me. And at the same time, I was hearing some genuinely cruel judgments from both heterosexuals and homosexuals about bis. Add to that the difficulty I was having sorting out my own feelings. I knew my feelings toward women were different than those toward men, and I wasn't sure what that meant. And things just got very confusing. As a result, it wasn't until I knew for sure that I was capable of having both sexual and romantic feelings toward both men and women, and until I felt strong enough to claim the identity in the face of all those negative judgments, that I finally began calling myself bisexual. I look back on my life now and see that I've generally expressed my domestic urges toward men, but that my romantic and sexual feelings are about equally likely to be inspired by a man, a woman, or someone in between. The bisexual community also offers more support than either straight land or gay land for my rather ambiguous gender presentation. Some days I like to wear red lipstick and heels, and other days men's trousers and Oxfords. So, bisexual is the identity that fits me best, and where I expect to stay.
Heterosexuals. In bygone decades, there were relatively few models for heterosexual interaction in mainstream culture. An Ozzie and Harriet household, monogamous, patriarchal, and focused on conformity and child-rearing, was presented to us all as our sexual and romantic ideal. Your authors are very glad to have outlived this era. Modern heterosexuality offers a plethora of options for happy sluthood, from long-term V triads, where two partners are both sexual with one hub partner, but not with each other, to orgiastic recreational sex with lots of possibilities in between, including open relationships, secondary partners, polypods, and intimately extended families we sometimes call constellations. In the past, non-monogamous heterosexual interactions were called wife-swapping, a term with a built-in sexist bias that we find offensive. Today, heterosexuals seeking no-strings sex outside a primary relationship often seek out the swing community. These groups are well worth looking at for what they have to teach us about how heterosexual men and women can interact outside the confines of the shoulds of mainstream monogamous culture. Swinging is a broad term that gets used to define a wide variety of interactions, ranging from long-term two-couple sexual pairings through the wildest of Saturday night puppy pile orgies. Swingers tend to be heterosexual. Although female bisexuality is relatively common, male bisexuality is often frowned upon. They are most often coupled and are often more mainstream in their politics, lifestyles, and personal values than other kinds of sluts. Some swing communities confine themselves explicitly to sexual interactions and discourage emotional connections outside primary couples, while others encourage all forms of romantic and sexual partnering. Swinging has offered many a heterosexual woman her first opportunity to explore greedy and guilt-free sexuality. In fact, we often hear of women who attend their first swing party very reluctantly, their second one hesitantly, and their subsequent ones avidly. We also like the sophistication with which many swing communities have evolved patterns of symbols and behavior to communicate sexual interest without intrusiveness. One now defunct local swing club used to have a fascinating code of opening doors and windows to communicate variously, keep away, look but don't touch, or come on in and join us. Transgender and genderqueer folks. Transgendered people form a variety of communities, all of which have much to teach to those who are interested in transcending their gender role programming. Dossie, in the early years of her feminism, found friends and lovers among male-to-female transsexuals who became her wonderful role models for how to be female, indeed often ultra-feminine, and still be assertive and powerful. What we can all learn from transgendered people is that gender is malleable. From people who take hormones to express male or female gender, we learn about how some behaviors and emotional states may be hormone-related. People who have lived parts of their lives in both gender modes, physiologically and culturally, have a great deal to teach us about what changes according to hormones and what does not, and what gender characteristics remain a matter of choice no matter what your endocrine system says. Genderqueer people, those who choose to live their lives somewhere between the usual gender roles, are softening the boundaries of gender and demonstrating what life without binary gender might look like. If you think this doesn't apply to you, that you are certain of your gender and that it's immutable, please consider that a great many people are born with the characteristics of both genders. Depending on whose definition you use, anywhere from 2 to 17 babies out of 1,000 are born with chromosomes and or genitalia that place them somewhere between the extremes of the gender continuum. We're not generally aware of these people in our midst because their appearance is usually surgically altered early in life. But it appears that mother, father, nature, doesn't believe in only two genders, and neither do your authors. And a great many people whose genitals and chromosomes are all lined up with biological norms nonetheless feel strongly that they would live more happily and appropriately when presenting as a different gender than the one the doctor assigned to them at birth. You may have such people among your friends and family without knowing it, unless they choose to tell you. Transsexuals can tell us a lot about how differently other people treat you when they see you as a man or as a woman. Perforce, transgendered people become experts at living in a very hostile world. It takes a strong-minded person to stand up to our culture's rigidity about real men and real women. No other sexual minority is more likely to suffer direct physical oppression in the form of queer bashing. It was mostly transgendered people, butch women and drag queens, who rebelled against police brutality in the famous Stonewall riots of 1969 that initiated the gay liberation movement. Transgendered people can teach us a lot about the determination to be free. Tantra and spiritual sex practitioners. Celibacy is not the only spiritual practice of the spiritually inclined. Early examples of religious communities based on non-monogamy include the Mormon Church, the Oneida community, the practices of Maituna and Kareza in Tantric Yoga, and the temple whores of the early Mediterranean goddess worshippers. Tantra as we know it today is actually a westernized form of classical tantric practice taught in workshops in most major cities, and in many excellent books and videos. Other classical spiritual sexual traditions have been updated for Western consumption in practices like healing Tao and Kodushka. Pagans and radical fairies come together for festivals and gatherings to celebrate ancient sexual rites such as Beltane, or make up their own rituals that are appropriate to current lifestyles, like the open sexuality of fairy gatherings, or the more subtle eroticism of sacred dance and drumming. These practitioners understand that sex is connected to the spiritual. As we said in an earlier book, every orgasm is a spiritual experience. Think of a moment of perfect wholeness, of yourself in perfect unity, of expanded awareness that transcends the split between mind and body and integrates all the parts of you in ecstatic consciousness. When you bring spiritual awareness to your sexual practice, you can become directly conscious of, connected to, that divinity that always flows through you. For us, sex is already an opportunity to see God. Sex workers. Despite what you might have learned from the TV or the tabloids, sex workers really are not all desperate drug addicts, debased women, or predatory gold diggers. Many healthy and happy women and men work in the sex industry, doing essential and positive work healing the wounds inflicted by our sex-negative culture. We know them as friends, lovers, colleagues, writers, therapists, and educators, as well as performers and artists. These folks have a great deal to teach us about boundaries, limit setting, communication, sexual negotiation, and ways to achieve growth, connection, and fulfillment outside a traditional monogamous relationship. Do not imagine that connections between sex workers and clients are necessarily cold, impersonal, or degrading, or that only losers frequent prostitutes. Many client-prostitute relationships become a source of tremendous connection, warmth, and affection for both parties and last many years. Practitioners of the world's oldest profession offer all of us the wisdom of the ages about understanding, accepting, and fulfilling our desires. These are the real sex experts. Cultural diversity. While we are looking at sexual diversity, let's remember that we live in a multicultural society and that every culture in our world, every subculture, every ethnic culture, has its own ways of creating relationship, connecting in sex, and building families. All of these ways are valid and valuable. One of the great joys of living as a slut is the opportunity to make intimate connections with people whose background is very different from your own. When you do that, you will find yourself tripping with some embarrassment over a lot of differences. The way Dossie and her friends from Japan used to trip over each other in doorways. In Japan, men go through the door first. Getting used to differences can feel awkward, but every time it happens, you've learned something new about how people go about being human. Maybe something that you learn will be just the thing you've been looking for that was lacking in your own culture. Dossie came from a small town in New England that had tried, with little success, to pound her into the form of a nice, respectable young lady. When she got to New York City, she discovered cultures in which strong women were accepted and respected. She got to have chutzpah. Talk about opening up a whole realm of possibilities. Boundaries in communication, connection, and relationship vary from culture to culture. Personal distance differs enormously. They say you can recognize the European American at a Latin American cocktail party. He's the one who is frantically backing away from everyone who wants to talk to him because they keep stepping too close. Volume varies too. Some cultures value being subdued and quiet. Others are dramatically expressive and, well, loud. We recommend that you look for these differences and suspend your judgments. Is that person who seems too loud actually able to be more expressive than you? Does that quiet person notice more? What's the intelligence of a person who hasn't read a lot of books, but understands how your car or your computer works? Who are these unbelievably self-confident people who make sexual propositions openly and enthusiastically and get really confused when you accuse them of coming on too strong? Maybe they have some ways of making connection that you could learn from. It is sad, indeed tragic, that so many of our sexual communities fail to welcome people from the whole world of cultures, of races, of genders, of sexualities. When you look at the people around you and dismiss them, or worse yet, assume you know all there is to know about them because of their skin color, gender, way of speaking, mode of dress, religion, or country of origin, you'll never get to hear any of the new and fascinating things that those people might have to say. Our friend James says, "I believe that every person you connect with on this planet has some sort of a message to give you. If you cut yourself off from whatever kind of relationship wants to form with that person, you're failing to pick up your messages, and what a shame that would be." When we are attracted to someone who comes from a background different from our own, and we fail to take that difference into account, then we will mess up what could have been a great connection. We think learning about cultures different from our own helps us to learn to think outside of our boxes, and that celebrating diversity can hugely expand our range of choices about our own lives. We recommend, when you are in the company of the unfamiliar, that you look for unfamiliar wisdom. You'll find lots of it, and it will make you richer. What can you learn? If thinking about all this makes you kind of nervous, we are not surprised. What you are experiencing is how threatening it feels when the customary boundaries you take for granted and believe apply to all social and sexual situations are very different from what you are used to. There are no universally accepted boundaries of gender or attraction among consenting adults, and the limits of sexual exploration are not handed down on stone tablets by some higher authority. When you look at people who meet your standards of happiness and success without buying into the world's standards of lifetime heterosexual monogamous pair bonding, you begin to see how such things can be possible for you too, even if these people aren't doing it the same way you want to. Recognizing other sexual cultures offers an opportunity to become aware of your own preconceptions and uncertainties. Listen to your fears. They have a lot to teach you about yourself. Think of Dossie's old dance club, the Omni. Not knowing what's what can feel scary, but think of it as a chance to scrap all your preconceptions and start from scratch. It's only by recognizing all the possibilities out there that you can truly choose the ones that work for you. Then you can be free to figure where you want the boundaries in your life, what your personal limits are, and if you ever want to expand those limits. Learning and establishing your own boundaries is a great opportunity and a serious responsibility. Accomplishing this amazing task will set you free to explore beyond your wildest dreams. Chapter 5, Battling Sex Negativity. From the slut's point of view, the world is sometimes a dangerous place. Lots of people seem to think it is okay to go to any lengths to stop us from being sexual. Some anti-sex crusaders try to make loving dangerous for women by outlawing birth control and abortion, leading to unwanted pregnancies and back-alley medical care. Others would outlaw access to sex information in schools or on the internet, so that our children cannot learn to care for their health and well-being and have no access to safer sex training that would teach them how to avoid spreading AIDS. In an appalling development since the first edition of this book, a vaccine that helps prevent cervical cancer in women is being met with resistance from Puritans who believe that inoculating a young woman against cancer somehow encourages her to have sex. Some people purporting to have the word from God preach on the public airwaves that AIDS is divine punishment for any sexuality that deviates from what they believe to be normal. We find such preaching far more obscene than any possible form of sex. There are places where some people believe that being a slut makes you fair game for violence. Why were you walking down that street at night in that short dress or tight pants? No wonder you got raped or assaulted. It must be the victim's fault, and you look so queer. No wonder that gang decided to beat you up. We are also considered fair game for other forms of oppression. Multiple sexual partners can be seen as a good reason to take all your property, your children, and your future income in a punitive divorce settlement. You could lose your job, or your promise for advancement, or your professional reputation, if the wrong people find out about your personal life. Judging ourselves. We hope this examination of the dangers of sluttery will lead you to ask yourself some questions. What is my experience of oppression and how does it affect me? Who do I have to lie to in my life? What are my closets? As you look deeper, you might ask yourself, what assumptions have I made about how my sexuality should be? Do I hold judgments about what good and nice people do that I wind up turning against myself? When we judge ourselves by cultural values imposed from the outside, when women believe they ought to be small and quiet, when gay people believe that their sexual choice is a neurosis, or when we all believe we would be better people if we were able to be monogamous, this is internalized oppression. When we apply these unfair judgments to other people who are like us, when we see our friends as too slutty or too free, this is called horizontal hostility. We suggest you look through Chapter 2, Myths and Realities, as a checklist to see where the beliefs that you learned in our sex-negative culture might be getting in your way. It's a harsh world out there. Those of us who choose to run our lives and loves in an unconventional manner should probably be prepared for the fact that many parts of the world will not welcome us with open arms. While there are certainly ways to protect yourself against some social, logistical, and financial consequences, we can't guarantee that there never will be consequences. It's not easy being easy. Ex-spouses, parents, in-laws, and others who don't share your values about the potential for inclusive relationships may be hostile. Your friendly neighborhood pastor may not be sympathetic either. Bringing both of your partners to the company picnic is not a good way to ensure your continued ascent through the corporate hierarchy. We recommend extreme caution in choosing who to come out to. Yes, we know you're blissfully happy and want to share your joy with the world. But remember, you can't untell. We know people who have lost jobs, child custody, and more because the wrong people have become aware of their sexual choices. Some landlords are reluctant to rent to groups that don't conform to the traditional family structure. Although this may be technically illegal, in our experience it's common, and we suggest that you be prepared to tell a teeny white lie when necessary. Why, yes, he's, my adopted brother. Some leases contain clauses that allow landlords to terminate rental agreements on the basis of immoral behavior or association with undesirable people, and most allow them to kick you out for illegal behavior, which in some states includes non-marital sex. Similarly, your personal love and sex arrangements are best kept out of the workplace. Both of us have lost jobs and clients for being who we are. While some cities and states offer some protection to people who are gay, lesbian, transgender, we are not aware of any that guarantee equal rights for sluts. Unless you are absolutely certain that your employer or your coworker is slut positive, not just gay, or a swell person with a great fund of dirty jokes, or someone who used to sleep around in college, we recommend a capacious and well-insulated closet. Legal agreements. If you and your partners are living in a somewhat marriage-like structure, with the expectation of sharing property, providing for one another in the event of illness or death, raising children, or running a business together, we strongly recommend official legal documentation of your status and intentions. Terrifying stories of lover kept from lover when one of them is hospitalized, a longtime partner left penniless and homeless after someone's unexpected death, individuals who have been parents in all ways but blood, losing an orphaned child to a partner's parents or ex-spouse, and so on should be enough to convince you that it's time to get official about all this. You do not legally own your children, and the legal agreements you can make about them are limited by that fact. You can use your will to express your desires about who will care for your children after your death, but the court may not be obliged to follow your wishes. In some cases, a non-biological parent can adopt a lover's children as a step-parent. But your children are not property, and you cannot give them to anyone you choose. States that don't allow same-sex couples to adopt also resist second-parent adoption, meaning if you are a child's third parent from birth, you have fewer rights than any parent from a second, third, or 15th marriage. Aside from that, it is possible and not difficult to make fully legal contracts to document your agreements on relationship issues. A publishing company called Nolo Press specializes in do-it-yourself legal books, complete with forms and step-by-step instructions. Janet and her previous partner chose not to engage in legal marriage, although, since they were an opposite-sex couple, they could have done so. Instead, they used a Nolo Press book to outline their legal agreements with powers of attorney and wills. Pay special attention to durable powers of attorney for finance and health care and to wills. While the law will not support everything an eager slut might want to do with his money and property, your chances of having your desires upheld by the law will be greatly improved if you express them in a formal and legal manner. If your agreements are particularly complicated, or if things of great value, such as a lot of money or a successful business, are involved, you may want to go beyond the do-it-yourself level and contact an attorney. If you have that kind of money, you probably know more about this than we do. Do try to find an attorney who is open to non-traditional relationships. We have neither the space nor the expertise to tell you all the ways that people with non-traditional sexualities can go about setting up their lives. Options range all the way from adopting your partner to setting up a business trust and beyond. But please, don't assume that your good intentions, heartfelt love, and general wonderfulness will protect you. Sluts don't have that luxury. Do your homework and get the law on your side. Chapter 6. Infinite Possibilities. The first edition of this book was subtitled A Guide to Infinite Sexual Possibilities. Now that we're older and a little bit wiser, even that sweeping statement seems a bit limiting. Sluthood means infinite possibilities of all kinds, not just the sexual. If you think a celibate slut is a contradiction in terms, we have a few surprises in store for you. Sluthood lives in the brain, not between the legs, and can fit comfortably and joyously into whatever consensual sexual and relationship pattern you choose. Asexuality and celibacy. Folks who say no thanks to sex are becoming an increasingly visible minority. Asexuality refers to people who simply don't experience sexual attraction, and celibacy to those who feel attraction but prefer, for whatever reason, not to act on it. We think that any kind of sexual freedom must include the freedom to not have sex without being pestered or pathologized. Traditionally, celibacy has offered a way for people to focus on intellectual or spiritual concerns without the distraction of fleshly lusts. If you're on a religious quest or working on your doctoral dissertation or undergoing a major life change, celibacy, short-term or long-term, may offer a valid means of narrowing your focus for a while. Similarly, people for whom sex or relationships have caused problems may choose a period of celibacy as a pathway toward self-examination. What kind of person am I when I'm being me just for myself? Dossie was celibate for this reason for 5 months after she left an abusive partner, after which she burst forth into feminism and conscious sluttery. Some people are celibate but not by choice. People who are incarcerated, ill or disabled, geographically isolated, socially unskilled, or underage may have trouble finding partners for consensual sex. Others are celibate simply because they do not, for whatever reason, feel like being sociable or sexual for a while, or perhaps for good. We do not see celibate slut or asexual slut as in any way a contradiction in terms. There are infinite ways of relating to other people, romantically, intimately, domestically, and more. And if you've opened your life and heart to as many of those ways as possible, you're one of us. Platonic relationships, aka friendships. One friend of ours drives us nuts by moaning, "I don't have a relationship, just all these friends." We have news for him and for you. Friendship is a relationship, an important one that offers tremendous opportunities for the things we need most out of our relationships: intimacy, companionship, support in times of trouble, and more. We are amused by sluthood skeptics, often straight women, who are appalled by the idea of loving more than one person, and who nonetheless have a best friend, someone with whom they share their deepest secrets, who may in fact be as important a part of their lives as their spouse or lover. If you have a lover and a best friend who are not the same person, you're already practicing many of the skills of sluthood as you manage each of their needs for intimacy, time, and affection. Friendly sex. If one of those good, intimate friends becomes your lover, what then? Will it ruin the friendship? Will it lead to something more, something that threatens another part of your life? These are the concerns of many people encountering the possibilities of friendly sex for the first time. The cultural ban on having sex with your friends is an inevitable offshoot of a societal belief that the only acceptable reason to have sex is to lead to a monogamous marriage-like relationship. We believe, on the other hand, that friendship is an excellent reason to have sex, and that sex is an excellent way to maintain a friendship. But monogamy-centrist culture affects us all. In single life, we can observe the land of one-night stands, in which you go home with a pickup and share some hot sex, but then the next morning you look at each other and decide if the relationship has life partner potential. If not, you leave with much embarrassment, and the unspoken rule is that you will never be comfortable with that weighed in the balance and found wanting person again. Sex as audition is detrimental to people and to relationships. It happens because most people have no script for sexual intimacy in the mid-range between complete stranger and total commitment. How do you learn to share intimacy without falling in love? We would propose that we do love our friends, and particularly those we share sex with. These individuals are our family, often more permanent in our lives than marriages. With practice, we can develop an intimacy based on warmth and mutual respect, much freer than desperation, neediness, or the blind insanity of falling in love. That's why the relationships between friends with benefits are so immensely valuable. When we acknowledge the love and respect and appreciation that we share with lovers we would never marry, sexual friendships can become not only possible, but preferred. So while you're worrying that your sexual desire could cost you your best friend, the more experienced slut could be wondering why you are the only friend she has never fucked. Dossie, when she was first a feminist, vowed to remain unpartnered for 5 years to find out who she might be when she was not trying to be somebody's old lady. She had many wonderful relationships during those years, a rainbow of intimacies, including the sharing of child-rearing and households and fixing cars and, of course, lots of lovely sex and affection. She decided that if she made sure to be affectionate, to let people know what she loved about them, that most would find a way to be comfortable with her without needing to be territorial, and it worked. Her quest helped her discover new ways of being in the world as a woman and as a sexual human being, the foundation of who she is and what she teaches today. Each relationship seeks its own level, or will, if you let it. Like water, you and whatever person has caught your fancy can flow together as long as you let it happen in the way that is fitting to you both. Living single. For some sluts, being single may be a temporary condition between partners, a recommended period of healing from a recent breakup, or a chosen lifestyle for the long term. Being single is a good way to get to know who you are when you are not trying to fit as the other half of somebody else. Learning to live with yourself and enjoy it gives you a lot to share with a partner when you choose to have one. Single sluthood has its own joys and challenges, which is why we're going to deal with it at much greater length later in this book. Single people can play the field in a variety of ways. One distinguishing dimension is how separate you keep your lovers. So one form of sluttery for the single involves multiple partners who have no interaction, indeed no information about each other. This avoids complications at the cost of limiting certain kinds of intimacy, such as opportunities for mutual support and the development of community. Or you may choose to introduce your lovers to each other, perhaps over Sunday brunch. This may sound wild, or impossible, or like a script for disaster, but don't knock it if you haven't tried it. Your lovers have a lot in common, you, for example, and they may very well like each other. Introducing your lovers helps prevent one of the scariest aspects of jealousy, which is the part where you imagine that your lover's other lover is taller, thinner, smarter, sexier, and in all ways preferable to funky old you. When you meet that other person, or when your lovers meet each other, they meet real people, warts and all, and so often wind up feeling safer. Introducing your lovers to each other also makes possible the development of a community, or an extended family of people who are intimately connected through sexual and personal bonds. As more people connect to each other in a variety of ways, including sexual, networks form, and something reminiscent of a clan or a tribe may evolve. Then the question of introducing your lovers can become obsolete, as they may already know each other. If you are a single person in any open sexual lifestyle, you must pay attention to how you are getting your sexual, emotional, and social needs met. You can do this in an infinite variety of ways. The important thing is to be aware of your needs and wants, so you can go about getting them met with full consciousness. If you pretend that you have no needs, for sex, for affection, for emotional support, you are lying to yourself, and you will wind up trying to get your needs met by indirect methods that won't work very well. People who do this often get called manipulative or passive-aggressive. Terms, in our opinion, for people who have not figured out how to get their needs met in a straightforward manner. Do not commit yourself to a lifetime of hinting and hoping. When you figure out what you want and ask for it, you'll be surprised how often the answer is yes. Think how relieved you might feel when someone asks you for support, or a hug, or otherwise lets you know how to please him. Think of how competent and just plain good you feel when you can truly help another person, whether it's by offering a shoulder to cry on, or that just right stimulation that leads to the perfect orgasm. Give your friends the opportunity to feel good by fulfilling you too. Partnerships. There are multiple forms of open relationships for the partnered, including serial monogamy, where one's various partners are separated in time, and the ever-popular non-consensual non-monogamy, otherwise known as cheating. We can think of these lifestyles as unconscious free love, but your authors feel both freer and safer when we love right out in the open. It is axiomatic that open relationships work best when a couple takes care of each other and their relationship first before they include others in their dynamic. So the slut couple needs to be willing to do the work we will describe later in this book, to communicate well and to handle jealousy, insecurity, and territoriality with the highest consciousness. Couples need to know and communicate their boundaries, to make and keep agreements, and to respect their own and each other's needs. Couples also need to make sure to nourish their own connection, to keep it happy, healthy, and fulfilling. Couples can have a secondary relationship outside of the primary or a number of lovers that don't get ranked in any hierarchy. Relationships vary in how close or distant they are emotionally and physically, and in how much contact is involved. Some may be short-term, while others may last for years or even a lifetime. Some may involve getting together twice a week, others twice a year. Couples new to non-monogamy tend to spend a lot of energy defining their boundaries. They usually focus more on what they don't want their partner to do, the activities that make them feel, for some reason, unsafe or downright terrified, than on their actual desires. Setting these limits is, for many couples, a necessary first step out into the disorienting world of sluthood. However, as couples become more sophisticated at operating the boundaries of their relationship, they tend to focus more on what they would enjoy and then strategize about how they can make it safe. How to create and follow this learning curve will be covered in more detail in Chapter 16, Opening an Existing Relationship. One woman of our acquaintance has a lifetime lifestyle of having two primary partners, one of each gender, with her other partners and her primary's other partners forming a huge network. Her relationships historically have lasted many years through raising children and grandchildren, and her exes are still active members of her extended family. In some open relationships, each partner seeks out other partners pretty much separately, often making agreements about who gets to cruise which club when, or taking care to avoid running into each other on the internet or in personal ads. They may talk about their adventures with each other and occasionally introduce play partners to their live-in lovers. Others seek out a close match with another couple so they can play, either as a foursome or by switching partners, with people they have met and chosen together. Many polyamorous couples make a fine lifestyle out of seeking relationships with couples who are most like them, who share their values and boundaries. Such pairings of pairs can become lifelong attachments and generate both hot sex and true family interconnectedness. More than two. People can make commitments to each other in numbers greater than two. The level of commitment may vary, as when an existing couple makes a commitment to a third partner or even a fourth. Relationships that add and inevitably also subtract members over time tend to form very complex structures, with new configurations of family roles that they generally invent by trial and error. Individuals and groups that come together as a threesome or foursome may find their roles within the family developing, growing, and changing over time. The person who feels like the mother of the group this year might well transition to kid or dad over time, or with each different partner. Triads allow three partners of one or both genders to form a family unit. Some people grow into triadic or quadratic families as they attain deepening involvement with one or more members who started as outside lovers. Others actively seek members for group marriages to fulfill their ideal of the kind of family they want to live in. We have heard of people who identify as trisexual because they are so strongly attuned to the idea of living and loving as part of a threesome. Balancing triads can be challenging, as in any ménage à trois there are actually three couples, A and B, B and C and A, and each of these relationships will be different. In a triad, as with the siblings of a family, all the relationships will not be at the same level at the same time. We've heard of lengthy arguments over which member of a triad should ride in the back seat of the car. If you get hung up on forcing these relationships to be exactly the same, you may hear yourself starting to sound like a small child screaming about why your sister got the biggest piece of cake or, in our adult world, the first orgasm. In all forms of ethical sluthood, but perhaps especially in triads, it is vital to find ways to transcend competitiveness. There's enough of everything for everybody. Hierarchies and alternatives. Many polyfolk like to use a hierarchical terminology to define their relationships. The people they live with in a marriage-like arrangement are primaries. The people they love but don't love with are secondaries. the people they enjoy spending, often sexual, time with, but aren't necessarily in love with, are tertiaries. While this terminology is pervasive and sometimes useful as a shorthand, we have some concerns about a system that inherently ranks the importance of the people in our lives. Janet says, E is my life partner and Dasi is my co-author. If I'm buying a house,